ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option, that it's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there. Welcome once more to The Minefield, where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing well, Waleed.
Was I presumptuous in saying welcome once more? I mean, this could be the first time people are listening. Why do I presume people who've heard this show before would, in their right minds, want to sample it again? But yet, here we are.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, you would like to think that we've developed at least the sense of having a backstory or at least a back catalogue. So, you know, true. I mean, if you are coming to us fresh and, you know, we sound unbelievably familiar with one another and rather fluent in what it is we do, well, you know, there's kind of a 10-year reason for that.
Yes, if you like this, you'll love what... Anyway, that's enough of the sales pitch. Is this the topic we keep coming back to or the topic we've never approached? Yeah. I can't quite make up my mind.
That's right. That's exactly
this.
Right.
Well, do you have an answer?
Well, we haven't quite done this. Okay. We haven't quite done this, and this interests me. For the last 3 years, we have been circling and touching on and pecking at. I've got some beautiful birds that frequent our backyard, and they tend to do all these things. They circle, they peck at, they touch on, but they never quite seize either fruit or flowers or other things. Well, this is what we've been doing to the issue of AI. And I'm interested, Willie, that the first, what, half dozen times that we've tried to tackle this topic, we really have tried to do the human dimensions of it. What does AI do to our sense of humanity and certain forms of labor or activity that we regard as being peculiarly human, or at least in some ways integral to what it means to live life meaningfully with others? I mean, I like the fact that we've touched on issues of creativity, of writing, of convenience, of the space for thinking. What happens when words and the use of words becomes mere tool rather than part of a reflexive process. I like the fact that our first venture into some of the legal dimensions of AI has been in the realm of intellectual property and copyright. But what's interesting to me is that where AI really seems to be biting politically is not in those more humanistic or, say, properly moral aspects, although what we're about to talk about isn't unrelated to the moral and the ethical domain. But it's where everyday life, it's where the material world, it's where, for want of a better word, our habitus and our future converge. And this is, let's just put it quite bluntly, AI's material instantiation in political and human communities, namely data centers. Mm. And it's really interesting. So here's what's really weird for me. You know, we've had doomerist prophecies about what AI might have wrought on human civilization. We've had concerns about AI overlords, about the possibility of the emergence of artificial general intelligence that will, in other words, a form of machine intelligence that outstrips human intellectual and mental capacity.
You say this in the past tense, like those things no longer exist.
No. What I'm saying is these things have been concerns that have been raised from the very beginning of, yeah, let's call it ChatGPT's splash into human consciousness, mm-hmm, popular consciousness. So none of those things are new. That has gone hand in hand with remarkable rates of usage of AI or AI-integrated products. For instance, in June this year, ChatGPT racked up more than a billion individual users. Around the same time, Google's Gemini racked up somewhere around 900 million. Meta AI has claimed more or less the same. So at least a billion active users individual users of AI and AI-integrated products in the course of a single month. And there are many proponents of AI that say that this form of mass usage itself represents a form of consent. If you were really all that concerned about what future AI might, what future damage AI might do to employment, to livability, to human civilization, whatever, would you really be using these products with so much seeming unthinking glee?
Yes, is the answer to that question. Anyway,
yeah, no. I think that's right. It's really strange how you have those two things that have more or less been going along together, which has, I think, to some extent emboldened many of the AI boosters in saying we have to accelerate development. There has to be more. There has to be more compute. There has to be more data centers. There has to be more money. There has to be more of everything, because if we don't get there, and the there usually means something like artificial general intelligence, if we don't get there first, then it's catastrophic for the rest of us.
Well, the bit you haven't included in that analysis, which I think drives a lot of it, is the geopolitical dimension.
Okay, that's right.
So,
they usually means China, by the way.
Yeah, if we don't, China will.
Yeah.
And China has scared some people with some of the recent models that have come out at far lower cost, for example. So that is definitely part of the situation. And then there's the prong that is domestic in this, which is about productivity.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
Here, I think it is important to place this in a broader context of a common economic story across the developed world of stagnating productivity and therefore a situation where economic growth seems to lead directly to inflation. The exception, it seems, being the United States, where AI is heavily integrated and becoming more so into the economy and is driving so much of economic growth and so much investment. To the extent that you mentioned data centers, I think it's something like 40% of the world's data centers are in the United States.
They're currently 4,000. There are 4,000 more that are scheduled to be built over the next few years. I mean, considering that,
if they can get to that point, this is an interesting element of it, is the backlash that's now growing.
But here's what's kind of interesting to me, Willie. You have this doomerist scenario. If we don't get there, they will get there before us.
And well, there's shades of doomerism in this.
Sure.
There's the doomerism that is the human race will simply be replaced because artificial intelligence will get to a point where it recognizes that we aren't very useful, we're expensive, so on, and we're just better dispensed with. And then there is the other doomer, which is a geopolitical doomism. And then there is the economic doomism. And I don't think these are all the same thing.
No, they're not. I agree. But I think what goes alongside that in really subtle but sometimes troubling ways is the what we could call the competitiveness anxiety. So, for instance, what's often said, if you think of the geopolitical argument being, if the United States doesn't do it, if we don't accelerate in terms of more compute, more data centers, more funding, then China will get there first. That same thing is kind of playing out within many countries. So in certain states within the United States, there are moratoria on the construction of new data centers that are either being contemplated or, in the case of New York State, has in fact been passed. There are 14 states where they're contemplating moratoria, one where it's actually happened. There's a bill that's more than likely going to be going to the Senate calling for a nationwide moratoria. But I think what's interesting is that part of the two-step that many of these AI companies have then been doing is we will build these data centers. Either you will reap the economic benefits of it, this huge investment that can pour into your community along with the grid development and tax breaks and all the other things, employment opportunities that go with it. Either you can benefit from it or someone else will. The same thing is kind of happening in Australia at the moment. Many AI companies are making representations, very firm representations to the Australian government about the building of new data centers, about Australia being what is being promised, what is being hoped in some quarters, as being the third leading host nation of data centers in the world by 2035. And again, the idea is if you don't cash in, then someone else will. You can hear that very clearly in the Prime Minister's own rhetoric. What's fascinating to me, though, Waleed, is that everything we've talked about has in a really crucial and now I think politically salient way, bypassed the dimension of popular or electoral consent. And there are people at a time of rampant polarization, there are people across the political spectrum that are mobilizing in ways that I don't think is exactly unprecedented, certainly not in the last. I mean, one of the diagnoses that we keep returning to is Pierre-Rosanne Vallon's notion of the aggregation of discontent. You can gather a whole lot of people around a common no when you want to mobilize the same or similar group of people around the passage of new legislation, the pursuit of something like equity or social justice, or the passage of progressive legislation. It's much harder to get people around a common yes. So I think this idea of bipartisan, broad-based opposition to something, that's not exactly new. What is unusual is that it is the lines that seems to be straddling, both in the United States and in Australia, and the way that it's taking place, this opposition to the construction of data centers is taking place in local communities. It's almost as though at a local level, the feeling of general powerlessness, of general anxiety, of general uncertainty about what this might mean for jobs, for environmental degradation, for the livability of local communities, but also what this might mean more generally about how it is that we live together. Those concerns are having a galvanizing effect and are spilling out onto one of the last remaining physical fronts, it seems to me, in the AI debate, which is in the, like I said before, their instantiation in the material world.
Yes. Can I thicken this a little?
Please.
I actually think that there are several dimensions to the opposition that's welling up in response to proposed data center investments that are not just about the, and sorry, and I don't use this pejoratively, this phrase, but the NIMBYism aspect of this, that are not just about, I don't want you in my local community, et cetera. Yeah. I think that's definitely part of it. And especially when these take place, or these proposed centres are slated for rural areas that are often quite beautiful and so on. There are definitely elements of that that are intrinsic in and of themselves would be enough, I think, to raise objections. I think we've seen a version of this in the Blue Mountains here in Australia. So there's that. But I think part of the problem is, for the AI companies, is that the case that they are making about what you will miss out on hasn't been made, actually. And it's certainly not been made very well. I will grant to you that that's the case they're making. Honestly, I'm not sure I've heard it very much. I think what I would detect anyway is a bit of a miscalculation on their part that would simply be assumed, that people would just kind of intuit that that's the situation, that political leaders might do that for them. We've seen hints of it, I think you're right to say, in Anthony Albanese's language, but note the about-face that the government has pulled off on AI and the orientation that they had towards it, where they're starting to acknowledge the concerns and wanting to impose standards, world-leading standards, they spruik. So that's a very different tone from what the government was announcing before or striking before. I think part of the problem is, you say jobs, I don't see the jobs. I see jobs in construction, which are relatively speaking short term, but this is not like building a nuclear power plant or a coal-fired power plant or something where there are jobs for life for whole communities. Once up and running, the economic model of the data centers doesn't seem to employ that many people. At least that case hasn't been made compellingly. But also, in what is this in service? So if you are skeptical of the whole AI project, yes, you might do the odd search on ChatGPT, but beyond that sort of like small scale use of it, there is an overarching anxiety. And we can have a huge argument. I think the argument is just far from resolved, frankly, as to what the effect of all this will be, whether it will be the end of the human race or the end of all jobs, or actually the creation of lots of jobs, or in the end, a fairly benign tool that doesn't deliver on the promise, or what or this full range of options as to what an AI-led future might look like. Wherever you stand on it, there is an anxiety out there that shows up again and again in polling that people have about what the future of AI will mean for their lives and indeed for human life generally. It's the single area, I think, and I stand to be contradicted on this, but I'm fairly confident in saying it. It's the single area where Donald Trump is most out of step with his voters. Mm.
No, that's right. Can I just pull you up on one point? Unless we've seen different things, what has been striking to me is that in the list of, say, 6 or 7 concerns that people have concerning AI, for want of a better term, existential threats tend to be quite far down the list, around about 5 or 6. Up at the top is water, electricity, noise pollution, environmental damage.
Which is the data center objection.
Which is the data center objection, yes, yes.
Yeah. By the way, what other thing can you think of where existential threat is in the top 5 concerns?
Yes, climate change.
I think to say it's in the top 5 concerns and therefore somehow downplay. No, this is the nature of the question that populations that have no way of understanding this with an expert eye or seeing this with an expert eye that they're latching onto is that the ramifications are potentially enormous and they have to try to make sense of all of these things. And so the anxiety that comes along with that is huge. So in the end, it seems to me that a good degree of the objection, the resentment, the resistance to data center investment, yes, is environmental, but is also hitched to this fact that people don't believe in the overarching project terribly much.
Mm, I think that's right.
It's not as though they're being asked to make a sacrifice in the short term for undeniable benefits for which they are hankering in the medium or long term. They're being asked to make sacrifices to things that matter to them in the short term, with the possibility that the outcome of that will be some disaster, some dystopia that they'd rather not inhabit. When you add all those things together, then you get this, it's no wonder that you get this sort of cross-party alliance.
But you're also missing one, I think, piece of the puzzle, which is if the overall project was, say, a little bit more overtly benign or self-evidently philanthropic, then this kind of sacrifice, there's this lovely phrase for the inevitabilist and scaling logic that undergirds all this. It's number go up. Whatever the underlying logic of all this is, there always has to be more. The number, the amount that we need always has to go up. If that logic undergirds something that was more self-evidently benign or clearly philanthropic, I think, you know, I mean, data centers have existed in Australia long before the AI boom. There are close to 300 data centers in Australia. A lot of people wouldn't know that, but, you know, these are the things that look after sort of video calls and online banking and that sort of thing. It's the fact that this is about AI itself, and it's the fact that AI at this moment is politically inflected, not just because of the amount of money that is co-implicated in American and UK and European and to some extent Australian politics, but it's also because of the general concern about the existence of these immensely powerful oligarchs that now sit atop.
And that the benefits will flow simply to them.
That's
the exclusion of everybody else.
In other words, Willie, this is like the new NAFTA. This is like a new free trade agreement that we are being promised is going to, I'm speaking in an American voice now, that's going to raise all ships, that's going to help all people, that's going to revolutionize the job industry, it's going to bring technological development, whereas what it actually does is it hollows out local communities, it offshores forms of productivity and manufacturing, and the people who gain disproportionately from it are those who already pay disproportionately less tax. So
and
there's
that. And what that means... Yeah. Is that a lot of the concerns about things like data centers don't need to be interrogated terribly critically.
Hmm.
So people talk about energy use and water, for example. It seems, if I listen to people who follow these things far more closely than I do, that actually the water concern is not that significant, that already the use of water is dropping dramatically. And that there are ways around that.
Yeah, and the water tends to be on a closed loop, and it's also, we use more water for other things that we don't care quite so much about.
Yeah, if you really cared about that, you'd look at like cattle production, or you'd even look at the water that you're using every day on the internet when you go watch a you know, scroll something or watch it, you know, and we're not, which goes back then to the question of not really being on board with the overarching project.
Yeah, that's right.
That you're not doing this in the service of something that you actually want or care about.
Energy is different.
The energy consumption is a different thing. Mm. And that is why I think the Albanese government's intervention that it would require data center investors to provide their own renewable energy was an interesting concession, I think, to the public mood. What's also interesting is the speed with which Liberal and country Liberal premiers and chief ministers took exception to this.
Yeah.
Don't tell us what to do. You're denying us the benefits. They should be able to use whatever power they want, et cetera, et cetera. And so you still have the remnants of the old world clash over climate and so on in that. But the mere fact that the Albanese government moved like that, I think, is very significant.
Mm.
The other thing I would say, though, that all these things are front of mind. What does disappear in this are a lot of the concerns that we've touched on in the past, and which I do think are there, lingering in the background for a lot of people, and they are the concerns about the technology itself.
Mm,
what exactly is it that this thing does? And isn't it really interesting, Scott, that of all the times we've revisited this topic, the one time we didn't was in the aftermath of Pope Leo XIV's encyclical on it, which was a magnificent piece of work, which Anthony Albanese himself cited and called superb in his recent speech at the University of Sydney.
Mm.
But where the Albanese government was prepared to say that about it, it wasn't really prepared to engage with the guts of that analysis, which was about what that technology means for humanity itself and the very idea of humanity. And I think one of the reasons that politics is incapable of doing that is it's long since abandoned any kind of discourse that has to do with the nature of humanity.
Yep. What
exactly it is. But anyway, maybe that's a sidebar. Maybe we can stop at the point of resource consumption and so on. But the key element here that I think we are definitely in agreement on is the way in which this is realigning certain forms of politics. When you have Steve Bannon on the same side as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, you know that something very serious is going on.
Or when you have the Greens and the One Nation Party, not exactly on a unity ticket about stronger AI regulations, but considerably stronger than the sitting government.
Well, it was Pauline Hanson's speech at the press club, I think.
Yes, it was.
One of the most interesting and overlooked aspects of that speech was her intervention on AI and her criticism of the Albanese government for just kind of leaving it in the hands of corporations and not paying sufficient attention to the public interest.
That's right.
And public trust and these sorts of questions. So, yes, the political die in a certain sense is cast. It's not moving anything, as far as I can tell, in the United States. I think the Trump administration or Donald Trump's executive order on AI amounted to very, very little. Mm. But in Australia, we have seen a shift. And maybe that presages the next turn in AI politics. All right. Are we done? Should we go to someone who actually knows what they're talking about?
Yes, please.
You are listening to The Mindfield, by the way, on Radio National. Waleed Ali, my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. And as always, Scott, we have a guest.
Our guest is Craig Calhoun. He's University Professor of Social Sciences at Arizona State University and Visiting Professor of Sociology at Princeton University. And it's our good fortune that he just happens to be in Australia to deliver the 2026 Thesis 11 annual lecture on, of all things, the decline of Western democracy. That'll be in Melbourne. We'll include the details to Craig's lecture and where you can go and listen on our website. Craig, thanks so much for joining us on The Mindfield.
My pleasure, although it's not an entirely pleasurable topic.
Do you have anything pleasurable to say about it, Craig, or should we go straight to the dystopia?
It's all mixed up together.
Okay.
But you were doing a pretty good job without me, I'd say, bringing up a range of issues. Let me just plunge in with one, which is to say, part of the moment and the debate is that these things are all connected to each other, that AI is not discrete. So you get this discussion of what about AI and we're on the path to artificial general intelligence, but then immediately it's connected up to other technologies that we've been using for a long time, other new technologies, to the climate debates, to debates over mining, over corporate power, culture, education, media, the Pope's encyclical and human dignity. So we have a hard time isolating this for a clearer focused discussion, precisely because in the real world, it's not isolated. It's only in certain kinds of rhetoric that it is.
Do you think that people in feeling that these things are integrated have a deeply theorized understanding of why that's the case? Is this just something that comes from the gut? What is it that makes these
things
integrated?
You'll be shocked to hear me say that I don't think there's a deep theorized understanding. But I don't think that's unique to AI, and expecting it would be strange. But it does mean they don't have a clear definition. What is AI? I mean, just consider, we've been building the artificial in various ways throughout the modern era and before. We've been shifting the nature of intelligence. So what does literacy, what do new kinds of print technologies and then recording technologies and all that do, if not shift some of the nature of intelligence and they filter into education? So there's a long backstory, and part of the production of the current debate is drawing a line against that backstory to say, no, AI is radically new. And so forget about that. Well, don't forget about it, because it actually comes in a flow from all those things. And even AI itself didn't get started last week or last year. This has been going on for a long time with various kinds of investment, including from the U.S. Defense Department and the government more widely, and pushing it in certain sorts of ways. So the notion that this is all new, in fact, gets in the way of thinking about just what it is. And let me just pick on one of the things that either you or Scott said here. There's an anxiety in this about corporate power. Hardly a new thing, but very central to the AI discussion. Complicated now by the fact that there are Chinese corporations that are major AI providers. By the extent to which the big AI players are pretty much all Chinese or American. It's a very skewed location in global geopolitics. Well, these are things that did not just happen with AI. AI came about in the context of this concentration of power with these large corporations, with the development of a new kind of structure to global geopolitics with the China-U.S. rivalry, but also a decline of the European voice in much of global affairs, and a new kind of organization of the spheres of influence of so-called West and so-called East, which is not really quite accurate, but pretty powerful.
So for those who are just listening to that, the first thing I'd recommend that you do is hit back 30 seconds twice and re-listen to what Craig just said. Because I think it's part of this
hard to do on the radio.
I know.
Yes, I understand.
Wait till it. But I mean, there is something fascinating here, isn't there, Craig, about, you know, yes, this is new, quote unquote, unprecedented technology that may well herald a new whatever in human whatever. Yeah. But there's also a very deep story that this current anxiety over AI is inheriting. You've just laid out one tremendous aspect, I think, of the geopolitical and also the political economic story. There are two other undercurrents that I've been thinking a lot about. One is what I made reference to before with the NAFTA agreement. Yep. This idea of the promises that go along with something that seems too good to be true. Yes, it might look like we're emptying your town of industry, but what's really going to happen is that further downstream, you're going to gain tremendously from this. And we know that in many respects, and you know, I think one of the things that the Trump administration has an awful lot to answer for is that it has more or less closed the debate, for the foreseeable future at least, on the proper and responsible use of tariffs. It may well be that tariffs are one of the important ways of addressing some of the forms of inequity and domestic immiseration that have been brought about precisely through free trade agreements like NAFTA. That's probably a conversation for another day, but that seems to me to be a big aspect of this story. The other part of the story, Cory Doctorow has this lovely, lovely phrase where he calls the reverse centaur phenomenon, which is part of the fear that many people have about AI, whether this is the full doomerist or whether this is a slightly more mild, you know, the dignity is going to be taken out of my forms of employment. The reverse centaur is basically the machine does all the work and the human comes behind to pick up the pieces, to do those annoying little things that the machine can't. In other words, we become quality control. I think what's interesting is that you put both of those things together. If you like, the legacy of something like NAFTA, and and the immiseration of communities that have had manufacturing depart from them. And then the fear that jobs are simply becoming less and less dignified. Yep. There's a kind of twin powerlessness there that seems to me to be really salient for the way that people, if not fully thinking theoretically about what's going on, at least are democratically emoting.
Yeah, well, and at least some of the more theoretically oriented folks are agreeing with them and then wanting to make a richer picture of that. But I think you're basically right. I think Dr. is basically right, that we've got this new technology, which we are being told by both its boosters and its detractors, is incredibly powerful, coming along after an era of globalization and technological innovation that a lot of people experienced as devaluing them, devaluing people in general, but devaluing them personally. And here's this new wave of technology. So it's hard to say we're starting over and this one will be good when we've just gone through a long period when the promises of globalization didn't turn out to be all that they were cracked up to be, when a range of new microelectronic and other technologies produced a whole lot of consumer conveniences, but maybe mainly giant corporations with giant profits, and not an unmitigated good for people and not a clearly better job market. So, of course, people are skeptical. They're suspicious, which is a big part of this. They're disgruntled. This came along at a tough moment after the global financial crisis, alongside COVID. Not in a happy time when people were prepared easily to buy utopian progressive stories.
But also, and I would add to that picture, a disillusionment with the effect of the internet generally and social media in particular. So what it seems to herald to me is a changing attitude. We can talk about economics, globalization and so on, but a changing attitude to the faith that's been placed in technology to court. So this sort of, you say it's a progressive idea. I would say, I would agree, it's progressive, but I would broaden progressive to be what everyone has more or less thought since the Enlightenment, that technology makes life better, that that's just what it does. Yeah. And there might be time lags and it might be a bit uneven, but in the main, would you want to go back and live before this technological device was invented or not? And the answer was always, no, I wouldn't want to go back. And suddenly there are people prepared to say, yes, maybe I would like to live before the internet existed.
Lots of them and in various ideological configurations. So one debate is this really progress? Is it bringing us a clear preponderance of the good over the bad or over? Really, there's a great word coined by Ruskin in the 19th century in Britain, ilth. He said, you know, we're always talking about wealth. We really need a concept of ilth, of bad stuff. And then we need to compare how much of each we're getting, how much ilth in the form of pollution or crowding or other problems come with the increase in wealth. And I think it's still the case that the media find it easier to count up the increases in wealth than the accompanying increases in ilth. Here, I think there's doubt about progress, and I'll just add, yes, there's doubt about technology, tout court, as you say. And this comes partly because we are seeing a return of active wars to our headlines and awareness, and they are mediated by technologies. And we're seeing the fires all over Europe in a sort of manifestation of some of the ilth that might accompany climate change. So there's reasons to be skeptical of technology. But secondly, there are a lot of reasons to be skeptical of government. And there is, across the political range, a fair amount of doubt about government. And it doesn't get stabilized as just doubt about right-wing government or doubt about left-wing government. It's doubt about government. Can governments do this job? Are politicians really trying? And that couples with the doubts about technology because of the worry that there isn't a serious effort or a potential success in the effort to manage the technology. And then add the third part, the doubt in economy. I mean, in the U.S. version of this, where never in my lifetime could any political figure say socialism and not immediately be condemned to the margins as a left-wing lunatic communist. Now you have prominent democratic socialist campaigners winning elections, winning primaries. The landscape has shifted with doubt about capitalism, right? And again, from right as well as left. There's doubt about whether capitalism is working for ordinary people from the right as well as from the left. And this is a big shift. So you've got three of the big supposed drivers of progress, right? Markets and capitalism, government, technology, all subject to doubt at the same time.
You're listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. That voice belongs to Craig Calhoun, Professor of Social Sciences at Arizona State University. Willie Daly is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Craig, that raises a kind of paradox, doesn't it? If we don't, we have doubt, I think, let me confine myself to your phrasing. If we have doubt about government, what then do we make of government attempts such as we've seen in Australia, though not in the United States, so you may not be familiar with it, but to at least make gestures towards reining in or regulating AI in some way? Do you think we're minded in those circumstances to say, well, it's about time government stepped up to the plate? Or do you think we're minded to look at this and go, oh, typical government, it's hopeless, it will not be able to do anything, this will be a disaster?
Well, you're right that I'm not a very expert commentator on Australia. I think that there have been interesting government moves. You cited the Albanese move to demand that there be an internalization of some of the power, costs, yeah. Water and energy costs of AI data centers. But I think in much of the world, and again, I won't say Australia because I'm neither Australian nor expert on it, this comes in a partisan form. We're in an era of a sort of hyper-partisan politics where one response is, do we like this policy or not? But another is, do we like this team, this side that is saying it? And so if we are on the labor side, we really don't like that national side. If we're, you know, in America, the Democrats and Republicans just can't bring themselves to like proposals the other make. They're having a hard time coming together. They're just very tiny signs of it.
Isn't AI an exception to this rule, though? I mean, when you have someone like, you know, Ron DeSantis as the governor of Florida coming up with an AI Bill of Rights idea and Bernie Sanders talking about something quite similar in moratoriums and so on. I mentioned Bannon and Ocasio-Cortez yeah. before. Like, I wonder if this is actually the moment where we are seeing signs, at least, of a willingness for government to intervene across the spectrum. My question is, if we distrust government as an axiom, what happens? What are our attitudes towards those interventions?
Well, so first off, our attitude to government can change. And can hold contradictions, because I think we both distrust and are angry about government and have desires for effective government action. And then we're in a kind of loop, and then government actions immediately get criticized and go around. I think on bipartisan action or finding a different center, I think all over the world, there's sort of a need for realignment of politics. People have been talking about populism for a generation here. It's one way of describing this. But I think what's going on is what counts as right and left, progressive and conservative and so forth, are very problematic descriptions for getting at what people are worried about. So yes, AI raises a set of worries. And the more you get to the local, there's a reason why data centers are the political wedge that is making this prominent, because the more you get to the fairly concrete local issue, is this generating constant industrial noise in my neighborhood? Is this raising my utility bills? The more it escapes from the simple polarization of politics. And that's the data center part of the AI story. And then it's not the part that gets to the existential threat or human dignity, which is easier to pull back into the idealized, polarized positions.
Look, let me add one complication to this. It's not a disagreement, but I think it is a complication.
You can disagree.
I know, and I might, but a footnote, something that I really should have mentioned before that I'm going to be kicking myself for days if I don't. I mean, it really must be said that one of the things, that, of course, that is contributing to the popular distrust surrounding AI is the active use of AI, as you mentioned before, Craig, in active military conflicts, and also the use of AI in surveillance of citizens, yes, in ICE raids and other things. And so this idea that it's simply a consumer technology or could be something that massively increases or enhances medical research or could be something that that will lead to universal basic income, there is blood on the hands of many of these frontier labs as well. And to separate, you just can't separate that, I think, cleanly from popular sentiment across the board. The thing that I worry about a little bit, some of the reporting about, for instance, the water usage of data centers is really complex. There has been misreporting. There have been exaggerated claims. There has also been underreporting and claims that seem to be doing the PR of the AI companies for them. What's interesting to me is that the popular response to both is disbelief.
Yes.
Why would we believe what either spin doctors say? Why would we believe what the media reports? Why would we listen anyway? The worse the figures, the more likely we suspect they may well be to be true. That is a symptom of our broader epistemological fracture. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of the irony of the moment is that in a time of epistemological fracture and yawning polarization, we have people on all sides of the political spectrum coming together in this form of shared opposition. What I don't quite trust, if we can sort of dig down a little bit on our current condition of mistrust, what I don't quite trust is the epistemic or the affective, if we think of the sort of political or democratically affective basis, on which that suspicion is currently founded. I think there is something absolutely right about local communities coming together and demanding a say in the construction of projects that have unquestionable, undeniable consequences on the lives of their communities. But when those sorts of concerns are nurtured in an environment of pervasive epistemic fracture,
yep,
and overwhelming distrust of almost all forms of public information, it kind of feels like they're drawing on the same fetid well, which then brings me back to Pierre Rosanvallon's, I think, wonderful critique of what he calls counter-democratic politics,
yep,
which is, if it comes together around a no, it can be potent, but it will not last. And that coming together around a common no, that can be bipartisan, can be cross the... I mean, the Gilets Jaunes protests, are they left or are they right? I have no idea. And in a real way, it didn't matter. But they also couldn't sustain. They couldn't translate into something more democratically durable than that. So I worry about the sources of our distrust, even if I happen to be in rich agreement with the fact of the distrust. I worry about the sources. I worry about the gathering around a common no, and I worry that this may not end up being democratically productive or durable in any meaningful sense.
So, really good comments. Let me pick up. I'm a fan of Rosanvallon, so this is good. We're in agreement on this. The Rosanvallon argument accents the extent to which the common no is easy but not stable. The common yes is hard, full stop. And
needs politics, and needs politics proper in order to arrive.
Well, exactly. It needs politics that includes institutions and stable alignment. So part of Rosanvallon's argument is that a pure democracy, the people trying to have power directly all the time, is unstable at any scale, beyond the extremely local. And so you actually need all these institutions that people at the moment hate, that people at the moment say, no, I don't want political parties. No, I don't want the courts to be able to overrule political actions. No, I don't want the government to be in the hands of bureaucrats. And Roosevelt was trying to say, actually, you need all of that. Mm. And this, in this, Roosevelt is echoing the founders of modern democracies back to the 18th century, who rescued a term democracy, which was generally in low repute since Plato and Socrates, right? Democracy will be a mob rule, and said democracy can be durable, more equitable, viable in a large scale society, and safe for minorities, if but only if there are a variety of institutional guardrails, rule of law, respect for rights, and some design features of the modern state. So modern states were always republics as well as democracies. If you look at their official names, often the word republic is there. And what it stands for is those things that aren't immediately democracy, but are the institutional conditions for democracy being stable and viable longer term. And this is what I think Roosevelt is talking about, and you're talking about, and you're absolutely right, right? So in our widespread frustration with situations, we often, different groups of us, want to bypass all institutional forms of democracy and get to something we think is more real. And that typically is an opposition, and it typically is short term. This is the point. Now, that raises the question, can parties be rebuilt? Are they irredeemably not just subject to doubt, but damaged and unworkable? To a very large extent, they become career mechanisms or mechanisms for raising money in different places. But it's hard to break out of the existing alignment and create something new. Can we rebuild government? AI plays in this in an interesting way. One of the promises people make for AI is it will make government more efficient and more transparent, make it work better. This is completely unproven, but it's a promise that's being made. Instead of having a giant bureaucracy, we'll have efficiency now through the use of new technology. And we really would like that. So I think the problem here of trying to abandon any kind of more institutionalized government is real, right? The catch is that the deployments of AI may be more on the side of further abandonment than rebuilding. They are really, AI is good at tearing apart institutions, schools and universities, businesses, actually. What does AI do for business? Huge profits for a small number of giant businesses, but a lot of upheaval in the middle level and small business parts of the world, a lot of accentuated potential for bigger competitors to come in and drive out locally run small businesses. So that's losing institutions too. And I think people who are frustrated with capitalism aren't necessarily mad at the person who runs the local dry cleaners or a cafe. You know, being able to distinguish the very large-scale, impersonal, distant forms of capital accumulation from, you know, the businesses we actually need to make our community thrive is oddly a weakness of both left and right. Mm.
We're rapidly coming to the end of the Minefield. If you've just joined us on ABC Radio National, Craig Calhouns is the voice you're hearing there, Professor of Social Sciences at Arizona State University. Waleed Ali, my name. Scott Stevens, my co-host. May I offer a perhaps Pollyanna-ish, naive...
Oh, good. Solve the problem.
...of optimism. No, I'm not solving a problem, but I just wonder if there is something emerging here that isn't as simple as a flat no. And that is that there seems to be a gathering around an idea that there are certain goods in life and that there are certain goods that need to be preserved and that it is politics's job to preserve. Now, we may disagree about whether or not the bureaucratic state is something that allows them to be preserved or is a threat to those things. These are disagreements over methodology. You could argue that they're disagreements in political theory, sure, however you want to categorize them. It's a different disagreement at least to the one that says there are goods here to be protected. It seems to me that there is something of a failure in politics, in certainly in liberal politics, and I use that term generically, in being able to articulate the very notion of a good, the very notion of shared goods, and so on, because it proceeds from this idea of a kind of, you know, individually driven innovative energy that will serve the common good in some kind of unplanned way. This seems to me a moment where people are saying no, that it is time for us to recognise, to perhaps articulate, and to defend certain things that we regard as being good in and of themselves, whether or not they're efficient, whether or not they're profitable, and so on. Am I over-egging this note of optimism, Craig?
Well, if you're being super optimistic about it, yes, but the direction is right. And I think people want sometimes to be able to say we. We've had a huge amount of celebration of the individual as the driver of all of this, but there are collectivities that matter. We actually do care about communities sometimes, and even in larger nations and all of that. So I want to say we, and then we want to say, what are the common goods that we care about for that we? We don't agree, and we're not very articulate. If this is politics, it needs to include a fair amount of public discourse. You know, what is it that we really value for this institution? What do we want a university to deliver? What do we want businesses to deliver? What do we want political parties to deliver? So what are the goods? Human dignity, right? Not a phrase that was very widely in political discussion before recently. The Pope picks it up in his encyclical. I think that a lot of people, well, of course we want human dignity. We haven't been talking about that. What do we mean by it? So we need that element of discussion locally and through the media at larger scale. And if we succeed even in just getting the debate about what we really want going, that's a big step forward. If we reach a clear agreement, so much the better. But agreeing that there are goods that are higher goods, they're not just things that translate into money and say, okay, I'd like $27 worth of human dignity, right? You say, no, human dignity is a higher good. We can't translate it just into money. There are a few other higher goods we can't translate just into money. What are they? And orienting our sense of who we are around these, this would be a huge step forward. Now, is AI in itself going to bring this? No. Is the debate over AI potentially going to forward this and advance it? Yes. Is that going to move faster than the exercise of large corporate power and technological head starts? That's the question, because it could be that the answer is no. The technological head start and the corporate power is going to dominate it and prevent that discourse.
But it's up to us to try. Yeah, but there are two really productive things, though, about this particular debate. The first is that it's very concrete. Yeah, I mean, Craig, you referred to higher goods, but it's kind of wonderful that the form these higher goods are taking is the lived reality of local communities, is the affordances of a particular space, of ambience. I think there's something about that. This is where the highest and the mundane or the quotidian kind of come together beautifully. The other thing that I'll confess I love about this debate is, I mean, I've been phrasing it in terms of a no. It's not quite a no, though, is it? What it is a slowdown. Yeah. And that is a salutary note for modern politics, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Charles Taylor and I argue this in Degeneration's Democracy. The very speed of the change that makes it escape people's ability to think it through is a danger. I think you're right about community being really important and people's ability to be sort of concrete in thinking about this and not just polarized is very valuable, but it can't be just community. You mentioned wars, and so did I. We can't save ourselves in an era of extremely rapid technological change, including AI, simply by protecting the local community. We also have to find ways to manage large-scale geopolitics so it doesn't destroy all those local communities.
So the question then becomes, does this moment, does this debate, does this collective no, if you like, does it become analogized into other areas so that it becomes more of a way of thinking than it becomes a response, perhaps an instinctive response to an event or an issue and so on?
Absolutely. And let me just say, a way of thinking means a way of discussion. One of the ways in which AI develops is by enlarging beyond individual brains through discussion, and then we get technological tools. But we had language. Language is a tool for improving our intelligence, and we can use it to have discussions on every dimension and at every scale of this, and that's where democracy comes in. And yes, it might slow down the rate of change, but that would be okay.
Craig, thank you so much. It's been great to have access to you while you happen to be in Australia. I feel like we've used a cheat code of some sort. But thank you so much for your time.
Of the nice things about coming to Australia.
Well, there are many, many nice things, including the lack of data centres for the time being. So enjoy this particular
trip. Don't count on that lasting.
We'll see what happens. Craig Calhoun is a University Professor of Social Sciences at Arizona State University, visiting Professor of Sociology at Princeton University. He's in Australia to deliver the 2026 Thesis 11 annual lecture on the decline of Western democracy. We'll include a link to that on this week's webpage. That is it for this episode of The Mindfield. Thank you very much for joining us. You can catch us anytime you like on ABC Listen. If not, we'll see you next time on The Radio Machine.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.